The Oracle Network.
Distractions Podcast, a weekly podcast that rotates between true crime, conspiracy theories, paranormal stories, folklore, a little bit of this and a little bit of that to provide you what we consider and what probably society considers a weird distraction from everyday life. I'm one of your hosts, Alex, and as always, I'm joined by my lovely best friend and co-host,
Christy.
And this week, we're talking true crime. Because, surprise, we can change the topics
each week. And we want true crime.
And we wanted to talk about true crime. And I'll get to why we're talking true crime. But before we dive into the episode itself, we have some hard-hitting questions we need to ask each other.
What's your distraction?
Yeah, what is your need? Well, Chris, I'll let you do it, because usually I ask you.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, what is your need for a distraction?
Works a bomb show.
A bomb show?
Oh, works a gong show.
Ah, there we go.
Works a gong show. We are back into the Omicron? I keep calling it, it's so funny. I keep calling it a chromium, which is a fucking bone in your shoulder.
Oh my gosh.
It's the Omicron, and we like have to wear N95s at work again, and I'm also distracting from bills because I started paying for my house.
Yeah.
And all the bills that comes with it. So that's my distraction.
So work and finances.
Yeah.
Sounds about on par with.
Because I have to go to work to pay my finances, but I have a lot of finances.
It's a vicious cycle. It's awful.
Adulting.
Yes. I'm going to backpack on that, and I'm going to say I need distraction from work because work sucks. I wish I took more time off around this time of year because I don't want to do anything. Motivation is out the window.
I feel like people get, like, depressed AF around this time of year.
Oh, of course.
Like, more than
same. Same. I understand completely. I also am not a big fan of the holiday season. As some may know, I'm more of a Halloween bitch. Shocking.
I'm a spooky bitch.
Yeah, more of a spooky bitch. But alas, here I am in the thick of it all. But anyways, I think it's time to shift gears and talk about true crime. What do you say?
Yes, tell me your story. I don't know what it's about.
Yes, so regular listeners may be curious as to why we're discussing a true crime case as opposed to a conspiracy theory or folklore one, because technically this week we should have been talking about either conspiracy theories or folklore, right?
It's because we can.
Yeah, but and the reason why we're not following our typical rotation is because I stumbled upon this case on two separate occasions and thought it was a good one to discuss on the show, being that it is Christmas adjacent and this episode comes out so close to Christmas, aka on Boxing Day. So hopefully if you're on your way to go Boxing Day shopping, or you're gonna pull a me and sit at home and just abuse your credit card.
Or me pull a double shift at
work.
At time and a half.
Like, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Whatever you're doing, hopefully you can listen and enjoy this true crime episode. So this week we're going down to a small Texas town called Corsicana to discuss our first non-murderous true crime case.
What?
Yeah, no murder in this episode.
Hmm.
Yes. So, without further preheating for the details, we're going to be chatting about the embezzlement case that took place at the Collins Street Bakery, which is known for their world-famous fruitcakes.
Hmm. I don't like fruitcakes.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan either, but when I think of fruitcakes, I think of Christmas, hence why I kind of want to talk about this case, you know, now, being it is...
Because of a Christmas cake?
Yeah, basically. That's my really small connection.
I read it about Christmas cake and I was like, perfect, it's Christmas time.
Excellent, on brand. Love that for us. So before we get into the crime, we'll discuss the history of the bakery and give some insight of the nut bar associated with the embezzlement scheme.
Punny.
Yeah, I sprinkled puns throughout this episode. You're welcome. Anyways, history of Collins Street Bakery. So the history of the bakery begins in 1896 when German immigrant August Wildman moved to Corsicana, Texas with aspiring dreams to open a bakery. Corsicana, for geographical reference, is approximately 50 miles south of Dallas, Texas.
Ooh.
And I am so sorry for anyone listening from Texas. I might go in and out of the text. What I think as a Canadian who is
a fake Texan accent. Yeah,
a Canadian who has never been to Texas, I might go in and out of a Texas accent. Which
followers lost now. Yeah.
And everyone has turned off the episode. Regardless, from what I gathered in watching the fruitcake fraud documentary on Discovery Plus, is that Corsicana is a small town filled with old money. So you got that old money that's been around for quite some time in a very small town. So you can imagine it's pretty clicky.
You found it on Discovery Plus?
Yeah, of course I did. I'm using my Discovery Plus subscription to,
to the fullest.
To the fullest. I'm taking advantage of it.
I see that.
Yes, and I am so happy for it. So shortly after coming to Corsicana, August purchased a storefront on Collins Street, hence the name Collins Street Bakery. You know,
it's on Collins Street.
Yeah, it's on Collins Street. Yeah, exactly. He began baking his authentic baked goods and breads. However, his business skills weren't necessarily rising to the occasion.
Like the bread.
Yeah, like the bread. Yeah.
Next.
It seemed as though August wasn't necessarily the most social person, which made it hard for his business to really take off. So he's having people come in, but he wasn't able to maintain a conversation with them.
It's very awkward.
I assume that he's probably a really good baker, but then just isn't a really good social person. Or maybe not really good business person either.
Maybe. He stands there and he's just like, do you want a tart?
Yeah, do you want
a bagel?
Yeah, just like stares and but says it in German, which is even more intimidating.
I'm not gonna speak German.
I
don't know it.
I can barely speak English, so let's not go down the German roll.
Guten Tag.
Yeah, that's about as far as I can go. Come 1900, August would find himself sugared with luck in the shape of a local entrepreneur by the name of Thomas McElwee. So the two working together kind of seemed to have great success, and the demands for the freshly baked goods seemed only to increase. So Thomas and August, I don't know how exactly they met specifically, but they linked up. They're like, hey, you know, August probably said to Thomas, you seem like a good business person. Why don't you join my bakery? And Thomas was probably like, fuck
you
yeah.
Bake bomb-ass bagels.
Yeah, you make bomb-ass bagels. Of course I'm going to join the bakery. And then they became friends, and then they continued Collins Street Bakery together, which is kind of cute.
That's very cute. It's like a Hallmark movie storyline.
Oh my gosh, it is! Like a Christmas Hallmark story.
Yeah, it's with Beth Franz.
Yeah, that opened a bakery together in the 1900s.
How cute.
So precious. Anyways, at around 1906, August had expanded the business. He had reportedly purchased a two-story home on 6th and Main in town. The idea was that the first floor of this location would serve as a bakery, while the upstairs would be a bed and breakfast, which dangerous.
Yeah, I'd be staying up there and I'd be eating all the gluten.
Well, that it's a smart idea though, right?
Oh yeah.
So this new business endeavor turned out to be a big hit, especially in a described booming oil town where people were often coming and going. The bakery began making their now famously known fruitcakes, which were sealed in tins, making it perfect to keep them fresh for the holidays or whenever you wanted.
Ugh.
Yeah, I can't get behind fruitcakes.
No.
Maybe I just need to try the right one.
No.
Yeah. Okay. Well. These popular fruitcakes seem to be one of the most requested items, being requested from not only all over the town, but from all over the country and eventually all over the globe.
Wow.
Yes. According to reports, the company reportedly began offering mail order sales in the late 1950s. So they started mailing out their fruitcakes. They were getting that popular.
I don't really understand how that would be so like fresh by the time it got to like
a
different
in a tin.
Continent still.
Tin. Tin. I don't know. Math, science, magic, tin. I'm just doing like the tin.
The fresh tin.
Yeah, I'm just doing like the tin movement with my hand. You know, it's a tin.
Okay, whatever.
Gonna keep it all together and what have you. This was a great move for the company, obviously, because it allowed for international purchases to be made and essentially kind of put them on the map in terms of business. So August and Tom would eventually pass on. However, the Collins Street Bakery would be purchased by Lee McNutt Sr., Harry Cook, and Bob Rutherford in 1946. Now, for a company that's been around for 125 years, some may be curious to know how much a year they may sell, especially how much they sell of their reported fruitcakes.
Yes.
So how many pounds of fruitcake do you think this company sells?
Well, just global.
Yeah.
I don't even know. A lot.
Is that your final answer?
Yeah, I can't put a number.
Just a lot.
Put me on the spot. I couldn't have time to math it in my head.
You know what? It's totally fine. Because in a direct quote from a 2006 Los Angeles Times article, quote, "The company annually sells about 3 million pounds of fruitcake, or about 1.5 million cakes. That's just fruitcake, which accounts for 98% of the bakery's total sales." That's a lot.
That's a lot of fruitcake.
That's a lot of fucking fruitcake. In that same article, it's stated that the company reportedly sends out a total of 12 million mailings of orders a year, with about 1 million customers in its database. The article, as mentioned, is from 2006, and a more updated number that I was able to find was from the Fruitcake Fraud documentary, where it was said that the bakery makes between $25 to $30 million in sales a year.
What?
Yeah, this place is no joke.
Jesus.
Yeah. So, I mean, it kind of makes me want to try their fruitcake. I'm not going to lie. After doing the research for this, I was like, fuck it.
They're still open?
Yeah, they're still open for business. Yeah. Okay. Oh, we'll get to it. So for listeners or Christy who are curious about the fruitcakes, even maybe wanting to purchase one, if you go check out the bakery's website, you can buy a fruitcake for $30.95 USD.
$30.
For a fruitcake.
Very big.
And a tin that you keep forever.
Apparently.
Yes. It even comes with a gluten-free option as well, which is...
No, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, I try it. Anyways, I just want to try everything because I did look at their website and they do have other things that look pretty good. But now that we've dished out the history of the bakery, we now have to talk about why we're here today, aka the true crime aspect. Starting in December of 2004, the company began noticing a change in their profits. They would have a really successful year in terms of sales, but after the numbers were crunched and submitted, they weren't rolling in the dough like they had projected. At first, they thought maybe it was a computer glitch, or maybe excess waste of ingredients. However, these were ruled out as not being the cause of such a deficit.
So wait, so the owners are looking into this?
Yes, they're
wondering
not...
Wondering why they got where the money's going.
Exactly. They're not sure as to why they're not making as much money based off of how many sales they've been making. So something's not adding up. Yes. So no one in the bakery understood what was going on, and it started becoming more of a mystery each year as the numbers continued to not add up. They, being upper management, turned to the bakery's accountant, aka who they called their corporate controller, Sandy Jenkins. So Sandy began working at the Collins Street Bakery in February of 1998, and he couldn't come up with any reasoning behind the lack of gain that the bakery was facing. It seemed like the mystery grew every year, and the bakery had to make some big changes because of this. For example, staff stopped getting raises, while some staff were laid off. This may not sound like a big deal, as a lot of times we hear this happening all over the world in terms of raises being frozen or layoffs, but for the described close-knit Collins Street Bakery work family, this was a huge blow. It wasn't until a woman by the name of Simitrik Walker was hired as an accountant clerk for the bakery sometime in 2013. Simitrik was given the large task of pulling out all of the bakery's invoices and asked to review them in order to see if perhaps there were any discrepancies. Simitrik got to work and quickly she reportedly discovered a transaction that was on a bank statement that wasn't in the bakery's system. This transaction was for a check for $10,000, which was written to Capital One Bank. Even though she was new and wasn't necessarily entrenched in the bakery's financial history as yet, she reportedly knew that this was a red flag because Collins Street Bakery didn't have a relationship with Capital One at the time.
So this is money coming in or them paying it?
Paying it. So this is money going out to Capital One, which they don't have an account with.
How much was it?
$10,000. Yes. So with this startling realization, Simitrik reportedly went to Sandy to ask him if he knew anything about this on June 20th, 2013. In the Fruitcake Fraud documentary, Simitrik explained that Sandy was technically her boss and that he had complete control of the bakery's financial system, from creating invoices to bank reconciliation. Basically, if anyone was going to know what was going on, it should have been Sandy. So Simitrik goes to Sandy and tells him about the check that had been cleared for $10,000 to Capital One. However, there had been no financial data related to it in their system. She reportedly explained to him that she knew the bakery didn't have a Capital One account and overall supposedly explained her confusion of how the check got cleared because of this. So she basically went to him. She's like, hey, can you tell me what this is about? Because I know we don't have an account with Capital One. This is for $10,000. It's already been cleared. but I don't see it in her system.
This is the new girl.
This is the new girl, yes. Okay. Yeah, Symmetric. So she went to Sandy, who had already been asked, like, hey, do you know what's going on? He said he had no idea. But then she came into the picture. She went to him and was like, yo, what's good? And let's just say...
gave some bullshit answer.
Yeah, so Sandy reportedly told Symmetric that it was a glitch in the system and he'd fix it. However, his face was reportedly telling a different story.
A $10,000 glitch?
Yeah, a $10,000 glitch.
Okay.
Yeah, because that just happens every other day, you know. No big deal.
Just chump change.
Yeah, just chump change. So in a direct quote from Symmetric from the documentary Fruitcake Fraud, quote, there was a ghostly white appearance that came over him, and I could tell that this conversation was making him very uncomfortable. Homeboy's got something to hide.
Yeah.
That's not what she said. That's what I'm adding, by the way. just to make that clear. But Sandy then informed Symmetric that he was going to take off for a doctor's appointment. Symmetric got the sense that something was amok based on the interaction she had with Sandy, which, yes.
Sandy was about to flee the country, it sounds like.
Well, we'll get to it. He doesn't actually flee the country, but...
he wanna.
He's gonna want to. Because of this, Symmetric reportedly decided to go do some further digging into the bakeries and voices and financial movements. In doing this, she allegedly discovered several more checks that didn't add up. After finding those 7 checks, she found 9 more and so on. More discrepancies that were not aligning up with what was in the bakery system. These checks would range in total amounts. For example, some were $20,000 or some were only $5,000. So a big wide range going on here.
That's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money for anybody, let alone a small town bakery. I mean, the bakery was making a lot of money, but I think...
so give away $20,000 at a time.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
Exactly, and not know about it. That's a bigger problem.
Sandy.
What's yeah, good? What's good, Sandy? In terms of the total amount, though, it ended up being, and this is a big-ass number, $16.5 million, which was spread out across 1,888 checks.
In what time span?
From 2004 to 2013, as far as my understanding. I might say the actual specific number later on, but...
Sandy making $16 million?
Yeah, so now this was a lot to digest, but the hardest part would be realizing that the over $16.5 million was being embezzled by one of Collin Street Bakery's very own. Sandy Jenkins was found to be the one responsible for using the checks over a span of almost a decade. But why would he do this? What was the money for? And most importantly, who the fuck was Sandy Jenkins?
Do tell.
Yes. Before we discuss his arrest and further crime specifics, I'll share a little bit of information of who Sandy Jenkins is. So, as mentioned earlier, Sandy worked for Collin Street Bakery starting in February of 1998, but I was able to find out some more history on Sandy in terms of what led him to Collin Street Bakery. Unfortunately, no birth dates or the usual specifics that I like to give, but alas, I do have some things I can work off of, so something is better than nothing. Sandy grew up in Wortham, Texas, and his parents owned the Jenkins Grocery and Market in Wortham. His mother, Helen, reportedly loved luxury items, and she really gave Sandy a taste of what life could really be like if he had money. According to the Fruitcake Fraud documentary, Sandy didn't really shine socially in school. However, he did have a friend, Randy, who was in the documentary, and Randy noted that it seemed like Sandy kind of lacked social skills. So he was a little bit of a loner, to put it bluntly.
Mm-hmm.
And because he didn't necessarily have a lot of friends, it kind of seemed, based on my memory from the documentary, it seemed as if people were kind of told to be friends with Sandy. Like, from my memory, Randy's mom and I think the teacher in one of his and Sandy's classes had suggested to Randy, like, you should be friends with him. He doesn't really have a lot of friends. But Sandy was kind of I don't want to say different as like a bad thing, but you know, a lot of kids I think his age were playing sports and going to parties, this, that, and the other. And Sandy, because he was so interested in luxury items, quote unquote,
yes,
he was more into fashion and dressing nicely and, you know, just...
same.
Yeah. I mean, I can relate to that. I would love to live that life, but yeah, he seemed different at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so... regardless, he did make a friend. Randy and him were friends, but he didn't really have that many friends other than Randy by the sounds of it. He could have, but Not that I'm aware of.
So he had Randy and he went to work.
Yes. Well, he had Randy. He liked to shop. He liked to look nice. I think he helped out with his parents' grocery store and that was kind of it. Oh, and he went to school.
Gotcha.
Yes. So speaking of school, Sandy would go on to graduate from the Dallas Baptist University with a business administration degree in 1973. He and his wife, Kay, had already been married for a year or so come his graduation. The two reportedly moved to Corsicana in 1988 when Sandy had a job transfer through a utility company that he was working for. The transfer was from Fairfield to Dallas, so Kay and Sandy decided to set up shop in Corsicana. Unfortunately, Sandy would be left jobless in 1995, and was diagnosed with manic depression in 1998, in which it's been documented that he did seek treatment for this. So he was taking care of himself at one point in terms of his mental health, which is always good. We clap for that.
Yes.
Clap for that. Take responsibility of your mental health. That's always great.
Progress.
Yes. Between the time that he was let go and when he did eventually start working for Collins Street Bakery, it's been documented that he did help out with the First Baptist Church as a deacon and helped out with Kay's catering business. So Kay had her own little catering business on the side going on, which kind of helped the income.
Okay.
Yeah. As mentioned, Sandy would end up landing a job at Collins Street Bakery as a cook, which his beginning salary was approximately $25,000 a year.
Not very much.
It's not very much, no. Sandy would work his way up to being a controller, aka the financial person for the bakery. Now, in terms of who Sandy was as a person, from what I gathered in my research, he was kind of a plain dude, you know, kind of a plain cream cheese kind of guy, from what I imagine. He was reportedly quiet, unassuming, but overall seemed to get along with his coworkers and those he interacted with. So, yeah,
approachable.
Yeah, approachable, but plain cream cheese. That's my takeaway from this description. Sandy's life on the outside looking in seems as if he didn't really stand out as an obvious suspect, or even someone that people would think twice that did it, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, unassuming, very quiet, kept to himself. You know, nothing really spectacular about Sandy.
Just the plain Jane.
Basically, yeah. In a direct quote from a 2016 Texas Monthly article by Katie Vine, quote, "People were always polite, but they never really warmed up to him, being Sandy, despite his attempts. He would try to remember important anniversaries, he wished them happy birthday, and he was quick to compliment haircuts and new outfits. But his efforts made little difference. Ever since he'd arrived in town, school, probably his whole life, Sandy Jenkins felt invisible," end quote. Which is kind of sad.
Sad.
Yeah. But to me, this quote kind of further emphasizes on the fact that Sandy Jenkins, on most accounts, kind of flew under the radar.
Yeah, he like wasn't standing out, or like he has fashion or whatever, but wasn't standing out in some other way sociably.
Yeah,
just kind of in the background.
And you know, when he first started at Collins Street Bakery, like he wasn't making, I think, as much as what he wanted to live up to his fashion standards or live up to, you know, the lifestyle that he had learned from his mother, right?
No, like I forget what time frame this is, but like 25,000 a year is not
enough. No, that was back in 1998, which I mean, I don't really
know. It's like still not a lot at all.
I know. I keep thinking of $25,000 in 2021 money, and it doesn't, like, that's in Ontario, that's below poverty line, right?
Mm.
So I don't know, maybe in 1998 it was a little bit more, but it's hard to say.
Yeah.
I didn't really do the deep research into comparisons, so can't really make a full confirmed comment on that.
Not an expert.
His wife, on the other hand, though, so Kay, reportedly was kind of more of the outgoing one. She was reportedly very loud, extroverted, you know, kind of the life of the party, so to speak. From what I gather in the documentary, she kind of dominated the room a little bit. So you have this really outgoing, loud person with a very flies under the radar kind of person, which...
The opposites attract.
The opposites do attract. And they attracted so much that they had a daughter whose name I'm not going to say because I also don't know it. And to respect her privacy, I don't think it really matters.
No. I thought you were going to say, I'm not going to say because I can't pronounce it. But yeah.
That would also be a problem that would happen.
Yes.
So Sandy wanted more out of life. He wanted to upgrade his car to a newer one. He wanted people to probably stop and notice him more than the way that they were. And I should mention, Sandy drove a Lexus.
What?
Yeah, it was an older Lexus.
It was still a Lexus.
It's still a fucking Lexus, right?
It's like today, they're driving an old BMW. It's still a fucking BMW.
Yeah, exactly.
Ugh.
Yeah, I don't.
Pink rocks.
Yeah, I don't understand that mentality. It's like, oh, it's old. No one likes, like, it's not new. Like, yeah, I get it. Don't get me wrong. I understand why you want to upgrade. But also, you're driving a freaking Lexus, man, and you work at a bakery.
No sympathy.
Yeah, that's where I lose sympathy points for Sandy at this point. Mm-hmm. Up until now, it's like kind of up and down, but now it's back down. So Sandy wanted him and Kay to be invited to the upper class parties that the wealthy elites of Corsicana were hosting. But without the upper class income, Sandy and Kay were often not included. Which, as a reminder, Corsicana, very small town, old money. You've got a lot of cliques happening, and if you weren't part of kind of the wealthier scene,
we're shafted.
Basically, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which I feel like happens a lot in small towns. Like, if you don't come from a family of money, you weren't really included in.
No, like, your shit, which is sad, but.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
Yeah. Good old social class shit.
Yes. Bullshit.
So, Sandy was struggling with not being invited to these parties. He also kind of dreamt of having his own funeral home, which is kind of a twist of events.
He wants your dream.
He wants my dream, but he wants it for different reasons. He, in a non-macabre way, Sandy Rapoli daydreamed of becoming a funeral home director, in which I'm going to directly quote the Texas Monthly article again, kind of explain this dream of his further.
Okay.
So, quote, it's true that he'd often dream of becoming the director of a funeral home, but his fixation had little to do with death. Rather, he coveted the sharp outfits, the rich backdrop, the immaculate black cars, the eloquence and reverent tone. So he liked the class behind it. He liked the...
Like a baller funeral director.
Yeah. And the money, because let's be real.
And you're like, dead people.
Well, no, I just don't want... I would just want to work with people that I don't have to talk to anymore.
Dead people.
Dead people, yeah. What's the opposite of working with live people? Working with dead people. That's my mentality around it. But regardless, we have two different dreams, Sandy and I.
Yes.
Basically, Sandy wanted to be dripping in elegance and wanted people to see him as not a boring, middle-aged, white guy who I previously referenced as being plain cream cheese. He didn't want that. He wanted to be spicy cream cheese. He wanted people to notice him from across the room. Be like, damn, who is that?
Little habanero over there.
Yeah, a little habanero, little cilantro. I don't know. He just wanted to be noticed, which I feel like we can all kind of...
Relate to,
right? Like, of course, everyone wants to be noticed. Mm-hmm. Unless, you don't, and then that's totally fine if you're the Grinch. But, like, it is what it is. He wanted the prestige that he had in high school, where he was voted the most fashionable a reported 3 years in a row. Now, he just sat behind a desk at a bakery and was barely being noticed. As presumed, he wanted more from life. He wanted that elegance, that wealth, and he wanted it fast.
He's like, how am I gonna steal this money?
Well, how do I get there?
Yeah, how do I get rich?
Yeah. So Sandy reportedly began accessing the bakery's petty cash for a few things here and there. He reportedly upgraded his older Lexus with a new one using the blank checks within the bakery's system, which, might I add, he helped get that system into the bakery. So he designed, like, I don't know if he designed the software or I kind of doubt that, but he implemented the change for
that
the bakery.
That would make it easier for him to steal.
Yes, in the long scheme of things. But I don't necessarily think when that was implemented, he had that kind of, oh, I'm going to dip in and steal money.
No, but it made it a lot easier.
That made it a lot easier later on when he did decide, you know what?
Fuck you.
I'm going to steal from the fruitcake guys and people. From the fruitcake people.
Yes.
So then after upgrading his Lexus with a newer one, he decided to pay off his credit card, which allegedly had a total amount of $20,000 owing.
What was homeboy's limit?
I don't know. I'm going to assume $20,000.
Okay. No one should own that.
No, that's ridiculous. What do you need a credit card for $20,000 for? What are you buying that you need that much credit available for?
Nothing.
Nothing. Nothing. You tell me one thing you need to buy that is $19,000 that you need to pay in one installment right then and there at the store, and I will believe you. But at the end of the day, I don't believe you.
No.
I don't believe a word you're saying.
Liar.
Yes. So each time Sandy wrote a new check, the software would automatically sign off as Bob McNutt, aka CEO of Collins Street Bakery.
Sneaky.
Yes, very sneaky. I can imagine this probably made it more of a rush for Sandy, as each time he put in the information in for whatever he wanted to get, he knew he didn't have to physically sign off on it. Therefore, Maybe he thought he'd never get caught. That, and he reportedly would mail checks over state lines, and would use money transfers as well. Sandy continued to dip into the petty cash to pay off credit card balances, which he would max out on doing kitchen remodeling, or having wild dinner parties with Corsicana's wealthy elite.
Ooh, la, la.
Yes. He also would begin expanding his wardrobe, which according to the Texas Monthly article by Katie Vine, Sandy was purchasing $600 shirts from Armani and Hermes, which I feel like I just butchered that, but you know what? It is what it is. I'm too poor to afford that kind of clothing, so
no.
If I can't afford it, I'm not going to pronounce it properly. Let's be real. But I can't pronounce this one, but that's because it's like a well-known one from, I don't know.
What is it?
Gucci.
Oh.
He bought Gucci shoes, but I feel like I also only know how to pronounce Gucci the way I do because of the rapper Gucci Mane. That's the only
reason.
Yeah, that's the only reason, because I also can't afford Gucci.
Nah.
Plot twist. He also had become kind of a regular jeweler purchaser. So in December 2006 alone, he had purchased 5 Rolex watches for $52,000. $52,765.75, aka his salary's worth that year.
What do you need 5 Rolexes for?
For all 5 arms that you have, because you are clearly...
You don't even need one, but first of all, 5!
Clearly, I don't even know what I was going to call him, but clearly you need 5. 3 for one arm, 2 for the other.
All the other limbs has been going on.
Exactly, because this man is just off the wall. Sandy and Kate also became regulars at a store called Neiman Marcus, which, according to Wikipedia, is an American chain of luxury department stores and has its headquarters out of Dallas. The couple had their own personal shopper at Neiman Marcus, who referred to Sandy as fruitcake and to Kay as cupcake.
What?
So they would come into the store and be like, oh, fruitcake, oh, cupcake, come on in, let's take you shopping.
Where did they get those nicknames from?
I don't know.
He didn't own the fucking bakery.
I know, but man, he was spending like he did.
Yes.
Yes. So the fruitcake and cupcake would eventually not make any more trips to Neiman Marcus at one point when it was discovered that the store had nothing more to sell them because they bought the damn stores out, basically. They bought everything that they wanted out of the... Right? You're making that face of, what the fuck?
I'm crossing my eyes.
Yeah.
How much money did you spend?
Oh, Jesus. We will get to it. The spending wasn't done, though, after Neiman Marcus. It wasn't, we've already bought everything at Neiman Marcus. I'm going to stop dipping into Collins Street Bakery's funds.
Then we're going to go to Gucci or whatever.
Or, yeah, no, go to Gucci or anything like that. They weren't done shopping by any means, shape, or form. Or I should say they weren't done spending money. Sandy and Paroli purchased a $658,000 4-bedroom abode in Santa Fe, and the couple often made trips to Aspen, Napa, and Martha's Vineyard via a private plane. The private trips alone costed them $500,000 of the bakery's money. Alone. Just the trips.
If I was his bosses, I'd fucking murder somebody.
I understand how they might have not pinned it on Sandy to begin with, and we'll get to why specifically, but... To me, I don't even know words to describe it. Because part of me thinks this is the perfect crime because he knows the financial system inside and out. He can take all this money and just kind of play dumb on with everybody else that he knows and say, I don't know what's going on. Maybe it's a glitch, this, that, and the other.
Yeah, this is a lavish life. And they're like, how do you afford it on your minimal year pay?
Here we go. So at one point, the bakery had no idea what was going on. And they went to Sandy to try and figure out the issues. Sandy couldn't, quote, figure it out. And so the bakery had to cut jobs, raises, and more while Sandy and Kay were living this lavish life that exceeded his yearly salary. Which begs the question, how did he get away with it for so long?
Yeah, like a decade.
Exactly. So for starters, he's been described as being someone under the radar, meaning not someone who would have been suspected for something like this. So that's already like one tick for him getting away with it.
One pro.
Second of all, he reportedly told his coworkers that the reason he was getting new cars all the time and able to afford trips here and there was because he was flipping the cars. So in another direct quote from the Texas Monthly article, Sandy told his colleague, Hayden Crawford, the director of the Putt Bakery's public relations, quote, "I'm a car trader. I get new cars, but I'm able to flip them. I'm probably paying less than you are and getting a new car every 5-6 months. He told others that a cousin was loaning him cars, the same generous cousin who was loaning him the private planes, end quote.
I want the cousin.
I was gonna say, I'm just gonna put that there if I have any cousins that are listening. Just wondering.
You get private jets.
If you got private jets and when my invite's gonna come in. Just saying. There was another stream of lies that Sandy reportedly told folks, such as he inherited a lot of money from his family, or that he sued his father-in-law regarding a trust fund, which Sandy won, among other lies that were apparently kind of being spewed around, so to speak.
Quite the storyteller.
Very much so. For someone who is labeled as unassuming and planned, I'm...
He seems pretty up there to me.
I was gonna call him planned. That's, you know what? Planned. He's planned. Plain and bland. Yeah. But for someone who is as planned as Sandy, he's getting away with quite a bit and also has a very elaborate luxury lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
With this new lifestyle, the Jenkins were being seen in a different, more favorable light by the town's elite, which ultimately seemed to be the goal. However, as we know from earlier, keeping this goal of living the high life was about to come crashing down. Symetric had told Sandy about the checks on June 20th, a Thursday, and by that Friday, Sandy's manager, Scott, had reportedly asked Sandy to meet him in one of the executive's office. Yes. Before going to meet with Scott, Sandy reportedly told Symetric that he actually bailed out of work early on Thursday, specifically stating that he didn't actually have a doctor's appointment, but that he was playing hooky to go house shopping.
For another house?
For another house in Corsicana. So he proceeded to then show Symetric the house that he looked at, which was located on one of the more prestigious moneybag streets in Corsicana. Which is kind of a weird flex, but like, okay, I guess. Like, why he was already so uncomfortable when she confronted him about the check.
And he keeps going on about his lavish lifestyle.
Why, yeah, exactly. Why would you then approach the person who clearly made you uncomfortable to then say, oh, I was looking at this like really expensive house on this really prestigious street. And yeah, I didn't actually have a doctor's appointment. I just was going house shopping. Like, why would you do that?
I'm a big liar.
Yeah, I'm full of shit. But it's a weird move. Life. Yeah, even Symetric in the documentary was like, I don't know what he was doing. Like, wrong move, buddy. Why would you say that? That just makes you look worse, my man. Anyways, Sandy then proceeds to go to meet with Scott and the rest of the executives, which... Yeesh, it's about to go down. So Scott reportedly asked Sandy to tell him about the void checks that Symetric had found, in which he produced photocopies of them to Sandy. Sandy reportedly shrugged his shoulders and proceeded to indicate that he had no idea about anything.
Sandy!
Yeah, I know. The bakery executives told Sandy that they knew he was embezzling money from them, and because of this, they were going to fire him. They already had a police officer waiting to escort him off the property and stated that they would mail back his office items. So once he was gone and like let go from Collins Street Bakery, they handed all of their evidence to the police, according to the Fruitcake Fraud documentary. Unfortunately, what the bakery had turned over was reportedly not enough evidence to make a case. Therefore, a more thorough audit of the bakery's accounts, along with Sandy's personal finances, needed to be done.
Well, to get the warrant.
Yes, let's get it going. So, even though more investigating needed to be done, it seemed as though the gossip mill in Corsicana was already working at full speed once news of Sandy's scandal left the bakery. Neighbors, friends, and acquaintances were stunned. Some allegedly had their suspicions prior to Sandy being fired. However, others really felt as if they had no idea who Sandy and Kay Jenkins really were. After being fired, Sandy and Kay reportedly packed their luxury items and stored what they could in a safe at their daughter's home in Austin. However, it would be discovered that Sandy had reportedly tried to discard some of his watches by I'm laughing because this is such a stupid move. He takes some of his luxury items to his daughter's house in Austin.
Okay.
But then he also tried to discard them in a lake near Austin.
What?
Yeah, so one day, an off-duty officer named Michael Alves, along with a friend, were on a walk near a lake in Austin. Like, just walking, enjoying their day, when they started noticing something shiny in the lake. So they got close to it. And it was a
Rolex.
It was a Rolex watch. So they keep looking around and around, and they keep finding all this weird shit. So eventually, because of everything going on, the FBI gets involved, right?
For some watches?
Yeah, for some watches. Because essentially, Michael takes them to a jeweler who then is able to contact Rolex to look at the serial number, which then they're able to say, oh, this person bought it on this date, right? Mm. And because of everything that was going on, I think Michael had reached out to Corsicana police and was like, hey, you know, I know this is happening. I just want to let you know I found these watches. And they're like, oh shit, we're coming. There was a total of 16 watches found, because eventually the FBI and police were sent to this lake to look in the water to see if there was anything else. And I think, hold on. So Michael and his friend found the first 16 watches, and with their dive investigation that the FBI did, they found another 22 watches, for a total of 38 watches being discarded in Austin in the lake.
What the fuck?
Yes. So gold coins and one gold bar was also discovered at the lake.
I'd take that.
Yeah, I'll take that any day. Fuck the watches. Because Sandy and Kay had so much money, on top of the notion that they were trying to get rid of items quickly, along with another home in another state, officials knew that they needed to move fast. So Corsicana police knew that Sandy was embezzling money across state lines, as mentioned earlier, which is a federal offense. So, as I mentioned earlier, the FBI did get involved, which is pretty scary.
Getting serious.
So FBI agent Christine Edson noted in the Fruitcake Fraud documentary that once she was assigned to the case, she started interviewing neighbors, friends, and coworkers of Sandy and Kay. These interviews were where she basically got the impression that people had their questions around how the Jenkins could afford the lifestyle while living on Sandy's $50,000 a year salary. It seemed that the Jenkins would eventually ditch their old friends to try and become friends with the town's wealthy and elite, and definitely were not hiding their exclusive items and basically broadcasted their wealth on full blast. The FBI were able to secure a warrant to search the home of Sandy and Kay, in which they promptly went to the Jenkins' home in Corsicana to confiscate the items they could find.
Which were quite a few of them.
Yes, so furs, jewelry, cars, everything that was purchased using the bakery's money was taken. In a direct quote from the NY Daily News article written by Rachel Blender to elaborate on how much was purchased, quote, Jenkins used its funds, being the bakery's, to bankroll a lavish lifestyle, including 223 private plane trips, over 1,000 pieces of jewelry, a $3.5 million watch collection, and a second house in New Mexico, prosecutor said. He, being Sandy, bought a new car every time it needed an oil change, purchasing 38 vehicles, according to courthouse news, end quote.
So an oil change.
So instead of just paying a shop to do an oil change, they just bought new cars. And these weren't like, oh, I bought a Ford Focus, or I bought a Mazda. It was Mercedes and Lexuses and like every luxury car you can think of they owned.
Yeah, and if you bought them brand new, it's like as soon as you drive it off a lot, it depreciates. And then as soon as you trade it in for a new vehicle, you already lost money on it and you're paying more money for your new vehicle.
But he didn't have to worry about shit because he's taking all the money from the bakery.
Yeah, but still so expensive.
It's so expensive and so stupid. So in addition, it was discovered that Sandy and Kay also purchased a horsehair mattress, which was worth $39,000, because apparently people need to lay on horse hair like the good old days. I don't understand why this is a luxury item or why this is a thing, but alas, a horsehair mattress for $39,000.
Rough.
I don't get it. In terms of the investigation, further evidence was found, and after getting a second warrant, Sandy Jenkins would be arrested at his home on August 12, 2013. He was arrested for money laundering, mail fraud, and making a false statement to a financial institution. Kay and Sandy, at some point after his arrest, did get divorced. I'm not really sure the date, but that's a crumb of information I got from the documentary. Jumping to May 20th of 2014, Sandy had reportedly pled guilty to the charges, but by September 2015, Sandy, who was reportedly 66 at the time, counts vary how old he was, was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison, which he was sent to Fort Worth Federal Prison. Eventually, Kay would be charged with conspiracy as well. However, according to the documentary, she maintained her innocence throughout trial and reportedly filed 7 motions to delay her jury trial. Kay, who was 64 at the time, pled guilty on May 29th, 2015, and was reportedly sentenced to 5 years of probation and 100 hours of community service. According to the NY Daily News article, Kay reportedly admitted that she had looked away from how Sandy was getting the money, meaning she probably knew but never fully addressed it with him. So they never had a talk of, hey, hon, I'm noticing you're buying a lot of fancy things for me. Where'd you get the money? Well, yeah, it's gonna speculate wildly, but it's kind of, I just have a hard time believing she didn't know.
No, she's acting stupid. She's like, I knew nothing.
Yeah, I had no idea what was happening.
All my millions of dollars over the years.
My arm is just so heavy with all these Rolex watches, I can't tell you what's going
and
on.
And probably fucking whatever those fucking expensive purses are called.
What purses?
There's like a special expensive purse.
I want to say Michael Kors, but they're not, like they're expensive, but they're not that expensive.
No. It's like a Hermes or
Probably.
Yeah.
It was one of the name brands I can't name because I'm too poor to name it.
Yeah, expensive. Like a Kardashian purse.
Yeah, something of that nature.
Yes.
The couple were also reportedly ordered to pay $12.7 million to Collins Street Bakery for restitution. The bakery, as far as my understanding, had received a total of $4 million by November 2021, which I believe was liquidated from the estate sale of Sandy and Kay's home. During the sentencing hearing, Bob McNutt, aka one of the executives of Collins Street Bakery, provided a victim impact statement, which I found quite moving. So, in a direct quote from the documentary, which once again, it's on Discovery Plus, quote, "It is hard to describe the depth of betrayal one feels when confronted by theft of a couple, Sandy and Kay Jenkins, who attended your father's funeral and then steal $50,000 from you the next day." End quote.
Gut punched.
Yes. Unlike our usual true crime episodes where we discuss murder or assault, this case deals with more financial loss, which on the surface may not seem perhaps as bad or devastating. I mean, losing a life is obviously like the worst thing a person can do.
Oh yeah.
But I also kind of felt the severity of the situation when watching the documentary, because people lost their jobs. People lost the ability to pay for their meals, to pay for, you know, rent, mortgages, what have you.
Getting a basic raise every year. Like
exactly. Because of one, well, two-ish people. One person in particular, right? And it's just sad. Like, Sandy, even though he was a planned kind of person, a plain bland kind of individual, they still considered him family. I mean, he had worked at Collins Street Bakery for so long and had developed some kind of relationship with folks.
That's why it's such a big betrayal.
Yeah, it's a huge betrayal. And, you know, I relate this to, you know, our usual true crime cases because with murder and assault, what have you, it's one human's betrayal on another, and this kind of fits in the sense of this is one person's betrayal against
lots of people,
and an agency that, or I guess I should say a company that really was so close-knit and didn't wish anything bad, as far as my understanding, upon one another. And then you have Sandy, who
took advantage of all of that.
You know, no lives were lost, but respect and trust definitely were.
Oh, no doubt.
Speaking of lives lost, though, a Corsicana Daily Sun article reported in March of 2019 that Sandy had died in a Fort Worth federal prison hospital on March 15th. Cause of death was not made officially public from what I was able to find online. However, it sounds as if some speculate that he may have died by suicide. I will mention, though, that in the Fruitcake Fraud documentary, they also noted that he died by suicide. It was really weird because online it's like, oh, he might have died by suicide, but no one really knows. But then in the documentary, they were interviewing, I forget her name at the top of my head, but she was, I think, part of the marketing team, like the director of marketing.
Okay.
And they're like, oh, how did you respond when you heard that Sandy died by suicide? And she's like, what? I didn't know that. And she's like, you know, I had heard rumors that he passed away, but I never heard that he died by suicide. I didn't know he took his own life. And then she started crying a bit because it's, you know, even though this person betrayed her and betrayed her company and the company she works for, it's...
But I was dead. And they are aware of how he died.
Exactly. Like, it's still devastating. And yeah, you know what? We've poked fun at him a little bit because, mm-hmm. you know, in this situation, he did fuck up. But
yeah, he's still a human.
He's still a human. And that is really sad. And, you know, unfortunately, where there's not really any more information as to why, if there's anything leading up, you know, mm-hmm. he did, based on the documentary, he called Bob McNutt a lot and said, like, I'm so sorry. I had nothing against you or the company. You know, I don't know why I did it. So stupid, this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
I think there was a lot of remorse by the sounds of it.
Just not over the last decade.
Yeah. It was more so, it seemed more so, more remorseful when he was already in jail.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So, previous to his passing, he reportedly was staying at Fort Worth Medical Center, which is a low-security prison hospital that houses those that identify as male who require special medical attention or that are struggling with their mental health. Kay would have completed her probation probably in 2020, so she may be free at this point. However, it's not clear as to if she is, where she is, and to be honest, it's probably for the best for her safety, I'm guessing, because God only knows someone might try and hunt her down and... I hope not,
but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So to kind of summarize this case, in a nutshell, being our last episode of 2021, I know. Although living a life of luxury may seem sweet, if you're going to go about getting that life similarly to how Sandy did, you're going to end up with a bitter taste. It does sound like Sandy may have struggled with self-image issues and really wanted to produce himself as greater than maybe who he thought he was. However, he got his hand stuck in the fruitcake tin, and all eyes would be on him in the worst way ever. And that is the Corsicana fruitcake scandal. What do you think?
That's a good little tidbit.
Yeah, different than our typical, you know, murder.
It was crimey, but yeah, not murderous.
Exactly. Well, I did say at one point I wanted to cover a non-murderous true crime episode. So I heard the case originally from Wine and Crime. Shout out to Amanda who covered it in, I think Bakery Crimes. So I heard about it and I was like, wow, that's interesting. Like, I've never heard about this case before. And then I saw the documentary on Discovery Plus and, you know...
Two and two
does equal four, so why not? And I will say, I believe there is going to be a movie based on this situation starring Will Ferrell.
Oh.
Yes, so stay tuned for that once it comes out. I don't know, maybe we'll watch it and give a review on Patreon.
Maybe.
But one thing I need to give a review on.
Your resources.
My resources. Because all my resources, 5 out of 5 stars. Amazing. Beautiful. Spectacular. So shout out to the Collins Street Bakery website, www.collinsstreet.com. And just shout out to them in general. Hope y'all are doing well this festive season. I bet you're really busy. And who knows, maybe we'll buy a fruitcake one of these days. Christy's shaking her head no, but you never know. Shout out to the KETK.com article. New documentary recounts the Collins Street Bakery fraud scandal by Michael Fowler on December 3rd, 2021. The Grunge article for their article called What Happened to Sandy Jenkins After His Arrest by Toby Argello on November 29th, 2021. The Texas Monthly article Just Desserts by Katie Vine in January 2016. The Wikipedia pages for Collins Street Bakery and Neiman Marcus. Thank you to the Los Angeles Times article. L.W. McNutt Jr., 81. His company sold fruitcake to the world by Claire Nolan, September 16th, 2002. Thank you, Discovery Plus, for their documentary, Fruitcake Fraud. Also, thank you to NY Daily News article for their article called Fruitcake Executive Sentenced to 10 Years for Embezzling $16.7 million in Texas. The numbers vary in terms of the total amount, but 16 point something.
A lot.
But that was by Rachel Blidner on September 17th, 2015. Thank you to the Corsicana Daily Sun article for their article called Tarrant County Medical Examiner, Jenkins Dies in Hospital by Sarah Allen on March 21st, 2019. And last, but absolutely, positively not least, thank you to the FBI Dallas website for their former Collins Street Bakery executive and wife sentence page on their website.
Whatever they have.
So, Christy, without further ado, can you tell these fine people how they can support the show, how they can contact us, and just overall, where to say hello?
Yes, all of the goods. So, where to find our show? You're obviously listening right now, so you know where to find us. Mm-hmm. But if you want to tell a friend, we are on Apple Podcasts. Feel free to go on, give a review, give some stars. It's a nice, just generous, free way of showing your support. Other platforms are Spotify, Good Pods, just search us. You'll find us somewhere.
Exactly. And on Spotify now, you can actually leave ratings on podcasts.
Yes, I did say that.
Yes. So that'd be cool if you left us 5 stars.
Apple whole things. Apple and Spotify.
Yeah.
Right away, please.
Wherever you can, sweet peas.
Gladly appreciate it. You can also go support the show for free using our other media platforms by liking posts or sharing posts on TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Again, a search in Weird Distractions Podcast. If you're looking for some more Weird Distractions, as always, we have our Patreon. So yes. If you want to go on there, there's a little 2 tiers for a little bit of money. You get bonus episodes, you get some stickers, you get some cards, you get some goodies. So you should check it out.
Yeah, and for December and January, you don't have to pay a thing to join. So
do it for free.
Get that shit for free. So because December and January are notorious expensive months of the year, we decided to pause payments until February 2022. So if you are kind of humming and hawing about joining our Patreon, right now is the best time to join because you get all of our content for free. And then if you like what you're hearing or seeing or experiencing, you can stay on and you can kind of decide what kind of monthly tier you would like to join.
Yes, and I'm going to shout out our current people we have following us. So Tom, Bailey, Angela, John, Alicia, and Lynn.
Thank you, we love you. Oh my gosh.
Mariah Carey
is back again. She stopped singing her Christmas songs for
once. She's a little out of tune, but
you know what? It is what it is.
All right. And other than Patreon, we have other ways you can, again, support the show. Check us out. We have Buy Me a Coffee. So there's a little sprinkle of some support on there. Going to Redbubble.
Yes.
We have lots of goodies on there. Any cover art, basically. You can get any item. And again, it's Christmas. It's close to past Boxing Day deals.
Well,
it's
technically Boxing Day today. So maybe there is a code that will be out that you can use. And hey, new year, new you, new merch.
Swag.
Yeah, both.
Yeah.
I love that for you. Get it.
Do it.
Do it.
Love it. And lastly, we are always doing our listener distraction episodes search. So
yes,
please.
We're searching right now. We're not doing them. We're just searching.
Doing our search.
Yes.
So please feel free to send in anything. Like, again, it doesn't have to be a personal encounter. It could be a dream. It could be a thought. It could be a heard story. It could be anonymous.
Well, maybe not a thought. Because if you come in with some weird thoughts that maybe you're a little...
Well, we'll screen it.
We have to screen our stories. But, you know, maybe you've been to Corsicana and there's a haunted place there that we don't know about. Or maybe you've tried the fruitcake and you want to give us a raving review of what the fruitcake is. Honestly, just anything at this point. We have some stories, but we want to make sure we have a good chunky amount so that we can give you the most in our next Listener Distractions episode. So Chrissy, where can they send these stories and these raving reviews?
Yes, please send me the deets to WeirdDistractionsPodcast@outlook.com.
Yes, and thank you so much for listening. This year for the podcast has been a whirlwind. There's been so much that's happened. There's going to be so much more on the horizon. Mm-hmm. There's things that we're working on behind the scenes that we can't really say yet, but they're coming.
Stay tuned.
Yes, and 2022, I think, is going to be a big year for Weird Distractions Podcast. And we just want to thank you for your support and listening, loving, and just being you. Dear listener, as always, if you need a distraction,
we got you.
Bye.